Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Todd, for the invitation to talk, and thank you all for coming here. It's going to be a challenge to follow such a great presentation, so thank you, Mark, for that, too. So my talk today is to describe a little bit of the work that we have been doing predicting hybrid performance in a complex scenario, and this is in the framework of the G2F project, specifically the GVIE MACE program within the G2F. So my first few slides are very relevant now in the context of the previous talk, but the idea of what I want to highlight today is this concept that when we have sufficient genotypic information and solid phenotypic information and environmental information that we can use to create training populations, the goal is to try to utilize that information to predict the performance of environments and genotypes that we cannot really see, which I highlighted here by the lighter corn plants. The trick is that these plants don't behave properly across environments. We see a lot of crossover interactions, as Mark alluded in his talk, and so we have to try to understand how different factors in the environment affect the performance of plants as these plants grow in the environment. And the task in hand is that we can measure different components. We can measure the environmental variance, we can measure the genotypic variance, and we can measure the interaction. And as you make these models more and more complex, you can extract more information. But there are limits to that. And this is a cartoon to demonstrate that this is a particular trait, plant height, which is considered a very highly heritable trait. And when we incorporate environmental and genotypic information in a specific model, we actually do a pretty good job predicting what the performance of these plants will be in this set of environments. When we add the genotype by environment information, that prediction improves from 0.64 to 0.77, and we will be happy with that response. But there is always these individuals at the bottom of the figure that, a little bit like Mark said, is how much we can tweak these models to really predict every single individual in a set or in a population and set of environments. So the question that we, in this context, this is sort of the motivation for the initiative that I'm presenting to you today, which is the Genomes to Fields initiative. The idea of this initiative is to create a framework that will allow us to ask some of these questions, to be able to understand how crop genomes and how the environment interact, and how we can use tools that will allow us to improve that prediction. This initiative builds on a long history of plain genome research that has flourished in the last 20 years or so, that has allowed a significant understanding of how our genomes work. And there is also a very large number of resources and ways to measure the environment. And so what the Genomes to Fields initiative is trying to do is to create not a physical infrastructure, but actually a living infrastructure of researchers that connecting a number of disciplines that are involved in this process will utilize that information and a network of phenotyping sites to be able to try to ask some of these questions and hopefully find some answers. So what we try to do is connect different sources of different tools and methodologies and resources such as high-throughput phenotyping to assess some of these variability and be able to ask some of these questions. And then, as I'm going to mention in a few minutes, the majority of the group that is part of this initiative are participants from the public sector. So a big part of this initiative is actually provide the framework for training the next generation of plant breeders in this extremely multidisciplinary world that we live today. So that is also a very important part of what this initiative is trying to do, and hopefully I will do justice and describe how the work of some of the young scientists that are already involved in this initiative have had a big impact already in this effort. So in a cartoon, describing briefly what the Genomes to Fields is, the Genomes to Fields is this umbrella initiative that encompasses things like the development of methodological and analytical tools, development of useful databases, not just to deposit data, but actually to mine data and be able to ask interesting questions, the development of high-throughput phenotyping tools, and as I mentioned, student training. And at the bottom of this umbrella, you can see this box that is this genotype by environment interaction project. And then surrounding this umbrella are all these different disciplines that have become more and more critical as we go through the process of trying to understand all these physical and biological phenomena that ultimately generates phenotypes of economic importance. So just to give you a perspective of the initiative, this is the map of different sites that were part of this initiative in 2014. All of these locations are areas where maize researchers were willing to be part of this initiative, and so that's how this initiative started back in 2014. This initiative grew to a few more locations in 2015 and a few more in 2016. So it's a very much a very dynamic process and a very grassroots type process. And the reason why I'm putting this map out is, first of all, because we are very proud of it, but also to say that if anybody in the room is interested in participating of this effort, we are always welcoming new participants, so make sure to talk to me. And this project is starting with maize and thinking about it as a model for hopefully future similar initiatives in other crops and species as we go forward. So a brief summary of what I'm going to talk about today is the data from 2014 and 15 collected out of this project. And so briefly to describe what we did in this project is each one of these locations had 500 plots that were evaluated. The germplasm that was used in this evaluation included sets of diverse lines, recently expired plant variety protection materials, and then lines from biparental populations, and also current breeding materials from different programs in the U.S. We had a set of about 20 hybrids that were common across all locations in 2014 and about a set of 45 that were common to all locations in 2015. And then the remaining hybrids were identified and located or set in the different locations based on maturity, sort of in overlapping sets of materials, again, to make sure they were adapted to the different regions. And as you saw in the picture, all the way from Guelph and Canada to locations that Seth manages in Texas. And we measure a number of different traits, such as plant and year height, flowering, stock lodging, and then performance traits such as grain yield, grain moisture, and test weight. And this table summarizes the effort in a few numbers. So we had somewhere between 23 and 28 locations in each one of those 2 years, and around 13,000 plots that we evaluated each of the 2 years, representing a wide diverse set of genotypes. And I think that is, in addition to the wide array of environmental conditions that this particular project is able to assess, we also had a significant amount of genetic variability that was incorporated, which is also something that is very unique to this particular initiative. This figure over here, this is work by Renee Walton, a research associate with Carolyn Lawrence Group at Iowa State, and she took the data from 2014 and 2015 and summarized, you know, looking at sort of some of the most extreme locations in here and highlighting New York and Texas. And the reason why I put this figure out is because when we think about what is the role of an initiative like this in terms of the future of plant breeding, and after these at least wonderful November month that we had in the state of Wisconsin, where we were wearing short sleeve shirts in the month of November, which I very much appreciate. But putting that into perspective, it might be that the environments that we see in areas such as Texas in 2014 and 2015 might become more of the norm on locations such as Iowa and Illinois in 20 or 30 years from now. So when we are thinking about what could be the impact of an initiative like this in terms of predicting the future, we might have to shift the map around and start thinking about how some of the information that we learn in locations like Texas will be useful in terms of agronomic performance in other regions of the United States and the world in the future. The other item that I want to highlight is, as I mentioned before, the level of genetic variability that we see in these materials. This is a summary provided by Cinta Romay from Ed Buckley's group at Cornell. And it's showing here the overlap of the materials that were used in the 2014 evaluation compared to the PI station materials at Ames, Iowa. So this is the whole collection of accessions, Imberlines at the Ames collection compared to the 2014 Imberlines. This is the 2015 collection, and including here the 2016. So as we go through the process of evaluating more diverse materials, there are also some interesting patterns that we are starting to see in terms of the influence of that variability in ability to predict. So kind of getting down to some of the initial work that we have done utilizing prediction tools with these data set, all of these Imberlines were genotyped using GBS. We had about a million SNPs for about 543 unique Imberlines that were evaluated. When we cleaned it up a little bit, we ended up with a set of about 200,000 SNPs, and then we used that information to generate synthetic genotypes, of course, because we are evaluating hybrids in the field. So we used the inbred information to generate synthetic genotype, just adding together the SNP scores of the parents to generate the hybrid. This is, again, a snapshot of the overlap of hybrids across years. We had a little bit over 1,500 hybrids that were evaluated. And in 2014, on average for each location, we had about 27% of the potential cells that were used or occupied by a hybrid. And then in 2015, it was on an average of 37 across all locations. So there is some overlap, but not a lot. And then when we look at what are the sources of variation that we see, as it is expected, given the range of variability or range of environments that we look, you can see that the environmental variance, or whether you're looking at a trait such as yield or plant height, represents a wide percentage of the variation. Genotypic variation still remains significant. And then for traits like plant height, the G by E was pretty minor, but in the range of about 6% for yield. So in terms of some of the initial prediction work that has been done with these materials, Diego Jarquin, also a postdoc, and with Aaron Lorenz, previously at the University of Nebraska, he started looking at different types of models that incorporate, again, some of the main effects of environment and line effect, and then also starting to incorporate the effect of marker, here represented by G, and then different types of interactions between markers and environments, and then interactions between markers and environmental covariates, and then the places where we incorporate both. And these environmental covariates were incorporated in the model. So we have, I actually failed to indicate, we do have a weather station, the same weather station across each one of these locations that is collecting environmental information such as temperature and precipitation and solar radiation. So taking information just simply, minimum, maximum, and medium for each one of these eight traits described, environmental characterizations described here, and then across the eight characteristics in the minimum, maximum, and medium across about 100 days that were common across all these locations. So instead of just looking at Julian days and the overlap, of course, in some places are planted much earlier. Texas is planting in February, while in Wisconsin we don't plant until May. We instead transform the first day of planting as zero and look at the absolute days of the growing season from that point on. So that's about 100 days. Those 100 days times those 24 covariates, 24 environmental covariates, were used for the implementation of these prediction work. And so what we tried to do is to just look at the simple scenario where you compare predicting in situations where you have the individuals, the genotypes in the environment present in other locations, which is represented here by the CV2, situations where the environments have been evaluated, but the genotypes have not been observed before. The converse of that is situations where the genotypes have been evaluated by the environments haven't been evaluated. And then the most difficult situation when you're trying to predict unobserved genotypes in unobserved environments. So just going through these results quickly, we actually saw what you probably would have expected. So in situations where the genotypes and the environments had been observed before, it is actually relatively easy to predict. Here we have 80% of the population was used as a training population, 20% as a testing. And you can see that regardless of the model that is used, there is a fairly decent probability that you will predict, at least be able to rank those hybrids in a fairly good way. Again, this is a graph representing 2014 and 2015, and the different colors represent the different models. You can do a very good job when the environments and the genotypes had been seen before. One thing that is interesting is that when environment by genotype or environment by covariates of the environment by the genotype are included, there is a bit of an increase in prediction accuracy, and I'll come back to that. When we have unobserved genotypes, of course, the inclusion of any kind of marker information will be beneficial. As you can see here, when we are trying to predict genotypes that haven't seen before without marker data, we are fairly unsuccessful. As soon as marker is incorporated, the predictions become much better. And we see again that when the genotypes are not have not been seen before, there is an advantage of including interactions between the genotype and the environment in some form, in terms of the ability to predict. That type of trend is actually not observed when the genotypes have been observed, but the environments have not. In this situation, we have genotypes had been observed and environments have not. And as you can see, again, the prediction accuracies are pretty consistent, and there is no real advantage from including any type of interaction information in the model. The toughest situation, of course, is when you don't have any environments or genotypes, and as you can see here, there is some differentiation or some advantage of including marker information, but there's no real advantage in terms of what specific model is used to predict the performance. Overall, the prediction accuracies are the lowest among all the possible scenarios, but it doesn't really matter what particular model is used besides the detail of just using some marker information. So the message from all of these is that, as we all knew before, these kinds of interactions are extremely complex. The interactions between environments and genotypes are extremely complex. And there is a significant amount that we need to learn in terms of what are the particular stages where environmental information influences genotypes. So one of the things that we want to do with this type of information is start to dissect exactly what G by E is and what are the genetic components that actually control G by E, and be able to use that information to inform some of the prediction work. So when you think about how breeders think about G by E, they think about it as the correlation of the performance of a single trait across environment. That is how G by E is thought about in the majority of cases. For evolutionary biologists, when they are thinking about the plasticity of genotypes, they actually think about how are additive effects of particular how is the additive effect of particular regions of the genome altered by the fact of a particular individual being in an environment versus another. So they start thinking about what are the types of genetic control that will allow certain individuals to be more able to sustain or adapt to changes in the environment. So that is a little bit of what we want to do with some of the data that we are collecting from the Genomes to Fields work. The kinds of questions that we want to ask is, if G by E is modulated by the genetic architecture of the trait, if the genes that are controlling the traits are the same genes that are controlling G by E, then the current models that are assigning value to polymorphisms and are trying to predict how they will perform will be appropriate. However, if G by E is controlled by different set of more complex regulatory mechanisms, we need to incorporate that information into prediction models in a different way. And some of the work of the crop growth model is addressing some of those, where you're looking at the actual performance, biological, physiological response of the plant, and not in the context of genetics, but understanding how the physiological states are altered by the different environmental influences. And that is important not only in terms of determining what is the most appropriate prediction machinery to be used, but it is also important because it makes us think about what are the types of variation that are important to keep in the germplasm for long-term breeding gains. So some of the initial work that we have done trying to address some of these questions is think about what is the genetic control of these plasticity, which in breeders' terms can be translated into a stability. So how do we quantify stability, and what is the genetic control of that stability? So what we did is we took the 20 checks that I mentioned to you before that were common across all the locations, and we did an stability analysis. What you see here on the x-axis is the mean performance of these 20 checks representing the gradient of environments from the poorest to the best environment for 2014. And then what you see plotted here is the performance of the 20 checks themselves in very much the same way as Everhard Russell did in the 1966 work. So this is the work of another very talented grad student at the University of Wisconsin, Joe Gage. What he did is he took for any hybrid that was representing in at least four locations, he plotted the value of that hybrid across locations compared to these gradients of environment. And then he fit a regression line to that calculation, and he extracted two parameters. He extracted the slope and the mean square error of each one of those, for each one of those hybrids and in locations. So what we were trying to do is to get to this concept of the type 1, type 2 stability versus type 3 stability. So type 1, 2 stability is defined as the environmental response to the gradient of environment. So hybrids that are have a relationship of 1 to 1 to that to the gradient of environments are considered stable on the type 1, type 2 stability. And then the stability 3 measures the amount of variability of each one of these hybrids compared to the regression line. So each regression parameter combined with the five traits that are described here became our phenotype. So what we did is then map those G by E traits using a GWAS analysis, and in this case we use gapping, and we look at the additive effect of those parameter trait combinations and pick the 50 most significant SNPs associated with each one of those traits. So what I'm going to show you next is the 50 most significant SNPs, which are SNPs that are associated to these G by E or stability parameter for these traits. And then we try to determine what types of genetic architecture, what type of genetic modeling we can see in this particular SNP. So this is following work that was done by Wallace et al. In 2014. And what you see here is the black line in this figure represents all 480,000 SNPs that we use in this analysis. The white line in the middle is where a particular gene will be present, and then we looked at the log distance upstream and downstream of the nearest gene to that particular SNP to try to understand where we see the highest concentration of associations of these parameter trait characteristics. And so the black line represents all SNPs. The blue line represents the combination of the type 3 stability with these traits, and the red line represents the type 1, type 2 stability with these traits. And what we see here is that there is a very significant enrichment of associations for these type 1, type 2 stability upstream of the closest gene to those SNPs. And as it is well established in the literature, that is where there is a significant concentration of promoters or short-range regulatory regions are common to be located. And so what we are seeing is that there seems to be an enrichment for the control of this plasticity be associated with probably modulation of the G by E that is closely more related to the control of the expression rather than structural changes themselves, structural gene changes. The other question that we ask, or it's sort of the next question is, are the traits per se and stability controlled by the same regions? And this is probably hard to see. There's just too much information. But the graph over on the top is the GWAS association, in this case, for plant height as an example. The GWAS of plant height for this population. And down here is the GWAS for the slope of plant height or type 1 stability and the mean square error of plant height on the bottom. So the first thing to highlight is that, interestingly, we don't see any associations that are significant for plant height itself in this particular set, and we see a lot of significance for the plasticity, but that's a different talk. But the interesting thing to note is that there is actually very little overlap between the associations of the trait per se and the regions that are controlling the plasticity or the stability. So there seems to be no overlap between the control of these two different phenomena. So to wrap up this presentation, I just want to highlight that knowing G and E is not sufficient to predict phenotypes, and the rules of the interactions are complex and actually very poorly understood. The framework of the G by E MACE project within the Genomes to Fields provides a very useful platform to test some of these important hypotheses, given its wide range of environments and genetic sampling. In terms of the initial prediction work, interaction models, they seem to work well in all schemes, and adding market information significantly increase the ability to improve prediction. Adding interaction components to the model increases prediction accuracy, primarily in scenarios that include unobserved genotypes more than unobserved environments. And in terms of understanding what type of genetic control is regulating these stability, there seems to be an enrichment for gene proximal regions of regulatory elements in that gene proximal region controlling some of that changes in the slope of these hybrids. So with that, our G by E, this consortium, everything that you heard today is just my interpretation of the data. It doesn't mean that anybody else in G2F agrees with me, so which is probably true. This is the list of the G by E cooperators. These are the folks that actually have generated all the data that I presented to you today, and then the institutions that are involved in this project. And thank you very much to all of you here in the audience and beyond. And this is the actual list of collaborators that includes the PIs of the cooperators and then individuals that are working on different projects related to high-throughput phenotyping and database development in addition to our cooperators. This is the G2F coordinating group, and the most important is thank you to our sponsors, a number of corn grower associations throughout the United States, and then the USDA, NIFA, has supported some of the projects that we are part of this initiative. So with that, thank you very much, and I will hold on questions to the end. So thank you very much.